Hello and welcome to Images, a public affairs program on KRWG that looks at the art, the flavor, the cultures, and the people of New Mexico. Hi, I'm Carrie Hamblin, the host of Images. Thanks for tuning in for an exploration into the hidden treasures of our area. Hajia Diner grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, during a time where the equality movement was beginning to take shape. With a doctorate from the University of Illinois at Chicago, she's published numerous books on the experiences of American Jews. She has been the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a senior postdoctoral fellowship at the Shelby Cullom Davis Center for Historical Research. And last month, she was in Las Cruces speaking at the Arriving in America, the Challenge of Immigrants and Minorities in Modern American History series, sponsored by the History Department in the College of Arts and Sciences at New Mexico State. On last week's program, we left off with a discussion of how Jewish people were treated upon arrival to the United States in comparison to other immigrants who were also coming to America. As we've talked about in previous images, Irish immigrants were treated as pariahs once their whiteness was considered not white enough. Hajia Diner says that Jewish immigrants came to the U.S. privileged because they were defined as white, allowing them the basic rights with citizenship. Furthermore, there was no linkage in the Constitution between citizenship and religion. That was a new experience for Jews. However, there were some Eastern states that had restrictions for Jewish citizens.
For a while, for a couple decades in Pennsylvania, in order to hold office, you had to take an oath on a King James Bible. Okay, well, a Jew can't, I mean, you could convert to Christianity, or you could lie. You could put your hand on a King James Bible and say, yeah, I swear on the Bible.
Right. But
it's important that the restrictions against Jews in Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Hampshire, North Carolina, those were the places that had them. And Pennsylvania gets rid of it fairly early on. So in a way, it's actually not very important. Maryland in the 1820s, they were not restrictions specifically against Jews, but against Catholics, who are also not going to put their hand on a King James Bible.
Right.
Okay, that's the Protestant Bible. And against unbelievers or non-believers, because they're not going to swear on a Bible. Mohammedans were specifically told. So it's important that these restrictions on Jews were not aimed at Jews per se.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but they were aimed at members of religious communities or, again, unbelievers who deviated from what was actually the established religion. After the 1820s, Maryland, which was the only state that had restrictions, still in place. It was the only place where there actually were any Jews. So New Hampshire had it, but there were no Jews there, so there was nobody to fight against it,
right?
And so Maryland in 1824 passes something called the Jew Bill, and it's a little offensive now to think about it, but it wasn't offensive to them, and it said Jews wouldn't be able to serve in the whole political office. So that's in a way on the side of they had any right that any other American got that derived from the state. Okay. Now, on the other hand, until the passage of civil rights legislation in the 20th century, first on state level and then on the federal level, private institutions were not forced to follow the same laws that public institutions were, required to follow. So while a state university could not have a quota on Jewish students, Harvard could. Okay, private universities could because they weren't liable for the same to follow the same rules. So private institutions begin to impose restrictions on Jews in such fields as college and university education, again, private schools, okay, not public institutions. Some employers, but again, private employers, so not the civil service. By the way, in Germany, Jews could not work for the civil service, okay, in the late 19th, early 20th century.
So it's kind of one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah, in the United States, the civil service was open for Jews, but a private employer, a hospital could say, we don't have Jewish, we don't allow in Jewish doctors, or a law firm. The telephone company in New York and Boston were notorious for always recruiting their, the operators from the Catholic high schools, girls who graduated Catholic high school, and they said they wouldn't hire Jewish girls because they had bad accents and they couldn't be the operator who says, operator. So these are private employers, okay? Places of social clubs, you know, like the country clubs, would have signs saying no Catholics, no Negroes, no dogs, no Jews. Okay, resorts. Okay, so these kinds of places, some in the housing field, that is, there'd be neighborhoods which would, you know, if it was not uncommon, in particularly in almost only in very exclusive neighborhoods, to have something on a deed called a restrictive covenant. And what these covenants were codicils to the deed. And the codicil said, I, Hossie Adiner, or whoever, Joe Smith, agree that when I sell this house, I will not sell it to a Negro. Okay, and Jews were often, whoever you didn't want to sell it to. I guess it's not unlike some of these gated communities now, mm-hmm. where they don't allow in children, for people with children, or anybody under a certain age. So these are, again, private commercial exchanges, which only after 1945, state by state, declared illegal. Mm-hmm. So New York State Civil Rights Law of 1945, it's the first one after World War II, all these practices become illegal. 1964, 1965 Civil Rights Acts say you have to, private institutions are subject to the same restrictions, okay, as anyone, you know, that they are also being regulated by Congress. So Jews are discriminated against in these settings. And so you can't say that they are treated the same as the kind of core white Christian native-born population. They're not exactly the same, but we can pinpoint the places where they suffered under disabilities. Mm-hmm. And what is notable is these were from private sources, which meant that Jews as immigrants or as Americans could express nothing but love and loyalty to the country and to its fundamental institutions and practices, okay, but still protest and condemn the private or the places in the private sphere where these actions took place, and also the fact that those discriminations took place in the private sphere forced them to strategize how to deal with it.
Did they strategize with other groups, though, like African Americans at the time, or Italian immigrants, or Irish immigrants? I mean, was there
it's a fabulous question, and that is also a post-World War II phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting that until World War II, and I think the Holocaust is the absolute turning point, until that, each one of these groups kind of does it by themselves. Okay, now, Jews were, as individuals, there are many, many Jews who are involved with the African-American civil rights struggle since the beginning of the 20th century. Joining the NAACP, not joining, founding, okay, the NAACP, funding it, participating in it at a leadership level as well as at a membership level. They're involved in many actions, okay, to make the society better for themselves and for others. But it's never done at a community level. So it's not the Jewish communal institutions that go to bat for civil rights, okay, but individual Jews. Mm. Okay, so you, and that individual Jew, throw out one name. He's not very well known now, but he was at the time a man by the name of Louis Marshall, who was one of the founders of the American Jewish Committee, one of the most, probably the most influential on a political level American Jew of the early 20th century. Okay, mm-hmm. He's active in the NAACP. He provides legal advice for them. He helps fundraise for them, but only in his own name, Louis Marshall, not in the name of the American Jewish Committee.
Okay, so there had to be that separation.
That's how they saw it. Now, was this a reasonable strategy? I don't think that's our role as historians, but one understand how these individuals who are in a way very uncomfortable in America, and what's, you know, well, how anti-Semitic is America? They don't know. Mm-hmm. And so they're really treading on thin ice,
right,
in doing this. Now, 1945, the Holocaust, I think, is a tremendous turning point. And then all of these Jewish institutions make an about face and they say, as institutions, as the American Jewish community, we go to bat for civil rights. Okay. As American Jewish institutions, we partner with Catholics and Protestants. Okay, as American Jewish institutions, I'll give a good example. I think it's a good example. As American Jewish institutions, we work with Italian groups and Irish groups and all these other immigrant or ethnic organizations to try to change the immigration laws, which had been based on national quotas. So we're no longer just sort of doing it as individuals, but as a community, we are standing. We go to court. We sign on as the amicus with the name of the organization front and center. Okay, and in a sense, what they saw is, as they understood it, the Holocaust was this transformative experience, and the Jews of the United States after the war are the only large Jewish community in the world.
Our guest today on Images is Hazia Diner, the Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at New York University. Well, when we're on the lines of the Holocaust, one of the things that it's one of your most recent publications was the silencing of what happened in the Holocaust. And so I'm wondering, what led you to research? And this is time period that you're looking at, 1945 to 1962. But you had some series of things happen before that, before you got to this point.
Okay. So the silence that the title refers to, and the book is called We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust. So it's focusing on the period after the Holocaust. The question of what was said and done and known during the Holocaust is also a phenomenal topic, and it deserves a really extensive scholarship, which hasn't yet been done, but that's not exactly what I did. So I did in the period after. So it has been the contention of both scholars and I'd say the kind of Jewish communal memory that after World War II, and until sometime in the 1960s, American Jews, like Americans in general, didn't want to talk about the Holocaust, they couldn't. Well, they didn't, they wouldn't, and they couldn't. That there was a kind of taboo. It was so shameful. It made American Jews so weird because this is a period where they're really integrating, where many of those barriers, which we talked about before, are falling. Okay, so for example, I mentioned 1945, the New York State civil rights law. Okay, opens up private, the private schools can no longer discriminate. Mm-hmm. 1948, the Supreme Court declares restrictive covenants unconstitutional. Okay, so all of these barriers are falling, and Jews are moving out to the suburbs, and they're entering in a way, almost all of them into the middle class. And the last thing they want is to be different than everybody else. And so, and what could be more different than, having this story kind of on their shoulders? So again, the contention, the truth, I put the word truth in quotes, is that the Holocaust was inconvenient for them. I read this in other people's scholarship, and I thought, I don't think that was the case. Okay, and why did I not think it was the case? Because it flew in the face of my own recollections. Okay, which is in a way, from the point of view of doing historical research, it is a great place to start, but not the final step. So in other words, you I'll actually use this as an example. There's in fact an important book which came out in the early 2000s called by Peter Novick called The Holocaust in American Life, and he's the one who really sets this in stone. And he says talk of the Holocaust never went beyond the kitchen table. Jews may have talked about it in their homes, but never in public. And so I read this book and I thought, what's interesting, because when I grew up in Milwaukee, every year there was a communal event called, it was the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial Program, and my father was one of the organizers of it, and I can actually picture the event, and I was always the child, because my father was the one of the organizers, I got to be the child orator who did a Yiddish or Hebrew reading, and then somebody else would read this text in English, and in fact, it's the text is the source of the name of the book. It's called, the text began with the words, "We remember with reverence and love the 6 million of our brothers," and so on, of the European exile. And so every year I would get up to do this, and every year the mayor of Milwaukee was on the on the platform, and the two congressmen, Congressman Royce and Congressman Zablocki. And so I said, how could that be the kitchen table if, for one thing, it's in this public space, and you know, the congressmen are there and the mayor's there, and they got up and they spoke also. And that meant their sort of administrative aide had put it on their calendar. So there was legs to this. And so maybe my experiences were unusual. Maybe it only happened in Milwaukee. But I don't know that. And as a scholar, your experiences cannot be taken as either typical or atypical, unless you, sit in the archives for, months kind of God knows how many hours, and you can establish that, you know, where your recollections, which could, by the way, be very faulty also, but in this case I was right, because I actually went back to Milwaukee and saw the program notes from those Warsaw Ghetto Memorial programs, but I also saw them for Kansas City, and I saw them for Cincinnati, and for Pittsburgh, and Boston, and New York, and Los Angeles, and so my experiences were not weird, okay, or just sort of out of some kind of left field, but this program, there was probably a little me, I can't tell from the program if it's a child or not, doing the same thing in all these other places. So the inspiration for the book was first my annoyance with other scholars for making statements for which they had no evidence. Okay, but secondly, I thought there was a great deal at stake in this truth about silence, and in a way, the truth, this again notion or this assertion that Jews in the period until the 60s didn't want to say anything was a condemnation of a generation that in a way is just not appropriate, because for the historians shouldn't be condemning, they should be understanding. But secondly, they didn't do what was said they did. And in addition, the reason the usual interpretation says it's sometime in the 60s. Okay, 62 is often given because most historians, again, would say with the Eichmann trial, when Adolf Eichmann was put on trial in Israel for his crimes against the Jewish people, okay, he's executed in 62, that's the turning point. Okay. Others will say, no, actually it was 67, and it was the war in the Middle East, we call the Six-Day War, that for the first time American Jews had something to be proud of rather than something to be ashamed of. And the Israeli lightning victory in 67 let American Jews bring the Holocaust out of the closet and now say, oh, yeah, by the way, this happened to us. And that makes Israel, in a way, the engine of change.
Okay.
Okay. But if there was no change, then Israel plays really no role, but it is a ritual. It was a practice within American Jewish life, both in terms of performances like these Warsaw Ghetto Memorial programs, in terms of liturgy, in terms of writing, journalism, creative writing, all that, and also in terms of political action on a range of concerns that came from the grassroots of American Jewry. And so, again, earlier I spoke about my mother's reaction to the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. And so I should just say that two speakers before Martin Luther King, okay, now this is an event that is telecast all over the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, it wasn't, again, at the Jewish dining kitchen table. Two speakers from before Martin Luther King was Rabbi Joachim Prinz, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany. And he spoke in behalf of American Jewry. He was the president of the American Jewish Congress. And again, just that is also kind of notable. And what he said, so King talked about his dream, Prince talked about his nightmare. And his nightmare was recalling what happened to him in Nazi Germany when he said people stood by silently while others, while their neighbors were being dragged off and murdered. And so here in this unbelievably public event, again, broadcast all over the country and all over the world, the representative of American Jewry makes the case for American Jewish participation in civil rights in the name of the Holocaust.
So why then was there this whole idea that Jews were silent about it?
Right. So I think it comes from two sides. And so from one perspective, and I don't know if I want to call it right or left, but from one perspective, which is maybe more internal to the Jewish community, there is a tendency to look at the post-war generation as only interested in assimilation, only interested in kind of being accepted by other Americans, as being very shallow, not very interesting, not very engaged people, and that this internal, again, Jewish explanation says it took Israel to give American Jewry some moxie, group a pride.
Right.
Okay. So it's very much in a way a kind of defense. It's making Israel the kind of chief shaper of American Jewish culture. Okay. Now, for the left, and this is where I put Peter Novick and another scholar, but maybe put that in quotes, named Norman Finkelstein, who wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry. From the left, they say that American Jews in the post-67 period, begin to talk about the Holocaust big time only in order to support Israel. And they don't really care about the Holocaust. What they care about is gaining support for Israel by guilt-tripping the American public. And therefore, until they became obsessed with Israel, they weren't interested in the Holocaust. But once they say, assume, and again, they don't have particularly good evidence for that, until 67, they really didn't care a lot about Israel. Yes, they were certainly supportive, but it wasn't a high priority. Once it became the kind of almost chief political agenda item for American Jewry, then they sort of resuscitate the Holocaust.
Well, I'm wondering, is there some truth, though, that members of the Jewish community may have wanted to fit in a lot easier?
Oh, I think they wanted to fit in. There's no question. Everybody wanted to fit in. All the American Jews wanted to fit in. But that didn't mean that they didn't talk about the Holocaust. And I know that I have seen archives and publications from the entire spectrum of American Jewry, from Reform to Orthodox, from politically moderate to politically very left. There was no right at the time. Big city, small town, New York, again, Kansas. I try, adults, children, they didn't see this as binary, that to fit in, you had to not tell the Holocaust story, but in fact, the two were possibly to support each other. Mm. And so, yes, they were definitely eager to fit in. They wanted the barriers to go down. They wanted to engage with their non-Jewish neighbors and to be seen as normal white Americans or normal Americans, because they are also so very supportive of civil rights. But that didn't mean that they suppressed the narrative of the Holocaust. And rather, every time they found a place, a means, an opportunity to weave the Holocaust story into their public rhetoric when they faced other Americans, they always talked about it. Even when I, looking at some of this archival material, found it really strange that they would talk about it, they always brought it in. Hmm. And so they're not kind of opposites.
Well, when you first started this kind of shook up your memories of, mm-hmm. of this, and you started kind of questioning, wait a minute, am I right on this?
So yes, I asked, am I right on it? And I decided I was.
Okay.
And in fact, I had a very wonderful experience in Milwaukee where I went to the local archive. There's a very good local Jewish history archive in Milwaukee. And I found out things about how the Holocaust was memorialized and talked about Milwaukee in front of my own eyes that I didn't remember. And so the one example that was to me most dramatic is I followed in the files how one Jewish organization that I didn't even know existed, okay, why would I was a kid, put up a plaque in the Jewish Community Center, said, to the memory of our friends and family and all the 6 million killed by the Nazis. And it was in a room that I was in thousands of times, okay, and it was the kind of rec room, it was the room in the JCC that had the ping pong table and pool table, and it was where all the teenagers hung out, and that's where you went to meet boys and, mess around, and I thought, why don't I remember that it was in that room? And the fact is, the archives are a much better guide than my memory, right? Because I can see the picture of them affixing the plaque on the wall.
Right.
And so, which is why, as a historian, memory is the beginning of research, or the beginning of knowledge, but only the beginning and not the the final word.
Well, I'm wondering, Hasha, with this, when we look back and look at, significant events in a particular group's history, mm-hmm. With the Irish, the potato famine, mm-hmm. with African Americans, slavery, and with the Jews, the Holocaust, how do you think we apply these lessons, learned now to what we're experiencing now?
Okay. In a way, I'm going to put slavery to the side because it's a, I think it's a very different story, different history, although obviously fundamental to American history. But if one takes the Irish potato famine narrative and the not just the Holocaust narrative, but also the pogrom narrative, that is these violent outbreaks against Jews in Russia, which began in 1881. And if you tell those histories, the Irish came to America because of the famine, the Jews came to America because of the pogroms, you take those groups and you put them on a kind of pedestal, and you put America on a kind of pedestal as a place of refuge, okay? Whereas, in fact, the Irish and the Jews come to America, and Italians and Poles and Romanians and Hungarians and Swedes and Danes and Mexicans and Dominicans and everybody, including the contemporary immigrants, primarily for economic reasons. And that if you say, well, this group came searching for freedom and they were refugees from persecution, that sounds really noble. And you say, oh, well, America was their place of refuge. They came for good reasons. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But these other groups, they're just coming to use American resources to doing something kind of a lower level, like, they're poor and their migration.
Taking our jobs.
Taking our jobs. Yeah, right. Their migration is not noble.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, economics were at the heart of all these migrations.
Well, Hajah Diner, it's been so nice talking with you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the second part of my interview with Hajah Diner, the Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at New York University. She is the author of several books, including her most recent, We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, available from NYU Press. If you'd like to hear this program or part one of my interview with Hajah Diner or other programs, you can find them all on our website, krwg.org. Find the radio button on the menu bar, and in the drop-down menu, you will see images. Click on that. You'll find this program and others there for you to listen to on your computer or as a podcast. I'm Carrie Hamblin. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I hope you've enjoyed the program and that you'll tune in again next week at 5:30 for another Images right before a Prayer Home Companion on 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces.